Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Cousin Aline was a formidable figure who intimidated everyone around her. She was 6 feet tall, thin and erect, with a long, severe white face. She patrolled her property in County Cavan like a figure from the Old Testament, wearing a long drab tweed coat, a wool scarf around her head, seemingly never removed, even indoors. Outdoors, long staff in hand, she inspected the farm and her large garden, and it seemed everything quaked at her approach. The sight of her, stalking slowly, would have us children scurrying in the opposite direction. Luckily, we saw little of her, except at mealtimes, and indoors our poor cousin Michael, visiting from England, had it even worse, when politeness dictated that no gentleman remained seated while a lady, especially an older lady, was on her feet. So when cousin Aline made her entrance to a room, it meant he had to stand, miserable and self-conscious, for the eternity it took to get herself settled. Her husband, our cousin Gerald, echoed her every opinion and judgment, repeating them ever more emphatically as she uttered them. In fact, we all concurred with her. It was the only thing to do. One's own view was totally unimportant and probably wrong anyway. Horses and hunting were frequently opined upon. Hunting was a necessity, and anyway, foxes enjoyed the chase. Everybody knew that. My own inadequate riding performance was dissected during mealtimes. What if the pony had bolted on me that morning? Cousin Aline barked. Ireland was an island, and he would have had to stop sometime. One's seat, or in other words, how you sat on a horse, was of the utmost importance, and a good one was achieved by riding for years without a saddle. And Princess Anne, poor thing, had a most unfortunate pony club seat. My sister and I, and sometimes the English cousin, were invited to stay during the holidays, and it is difficult to say if we enjoyed our time there. There was a constant stream of challenges, many of which we failed, but there was satisfaction and relief in getting through some of them. Posture, facial expressions, success in controlling bored and fractious ponies, conventions of eating, managing cutlery, a nicely turned thank you letter, all were commented upon, and there was little respite from the tests and reprimands of Cousin Aline. Easter approached, and the question of the Easter eggs arose. Where were they? A couple had been bought for us, and such frivolity was very unusual, but now they could not be found. I was a rather sneaky child who poked and pried through my surroundings in that house and others, as I felt that any and all knowledge gave me an advantage and might be utilised in the daily battles. I knew where the Easter eggs were. Naturally, I couldn't tell them, as that would reveal the fact that I had been investigating areas where I had definitely no call to be. On the other hand, we were desperate to get our hands on the glittering objects. I asked, oh so casually, would they be somewhere like the bureau in the dining room? Nonsense. How would they get there? I was stymied. Oh, such a nuisance. I suppose we'll have to buy more, huffed Cousin Gerald. Absolutely not, said Cousin Aline. We're not buying more eggs. They may turn up before they go home. Result, no Easter eggs. Sometimes I think about this incident now when Easter approaches and what two homesick little girls and their English cousin could have done. Resourcefulness, of which we had plenty, really came into play in the areas of avoidance, keeping out of sight and trouble, or anticipating how we could display heartiness and hardiness during a ride in the lashing rain. So proactive strategy was not strong in our range of skills. Now I fantasise about possible actions we could have taken. I feel we could have quietly removed them from the bureau in the dining room and consumed them, sitting side by side out under a hedge somewhere on the farm. Or another refinement, which I rather like, would have been to have left the silver paper wrappings neatly smoothed and folded back in the bureau beside a beautifully written thank you note.
Sitting on the deck of an old-fashioned wooden boat, as the morning sun beats down on me, my head is full of the New Testament Bible stories of my childhood. Jesus walking on the water, his Sermon on the Mount, the miracle of the loaves and fishes. For it was here, where I'm now looking out across the tranquil waters of the Sea of Galilee, that Jesus spoke to his disciples in words that I can still recall verbatim from my Sunday school days. Follow me, he told them, and I will make you fishers of men. As someone with no religious faith, how I ended up being invited on a Holy Land tour as part of a very small group of journalists, I have no idea. Still, when given the opportunity to visit Jerusalem and Nazareth and Tel Aviv, to float in the Dead Sea and take a cable car up to Masada, King Herod's mountaintop palace fortress, well, I reckoned I could cope with the God factor for a few days. What I hadn't reckoned on, however, was the mark that it would leave on me, especially Jerusalem. How wandering there along those congested streets, through the Muslim, Jewish, Armenian and Christian quarters, would bring all those childhood Bible stories to life, would make me question some of my preconceived notions and, well, leave me wanting to delve a bit more into the life and times of this Jesus of Nazareth fellow, this extraordinary man who spent his last days right here in this complex, chaotic city. Raised in the Protestant tradition, but as the child of a so-called mixed marriage, I have always been particularly fascinated by the Stations of the Cross. Why? Because they tell a story. Now I'm in the city of that story and able to actually see the stations marked along the Via Dolorosa, the route where Jesus walked to his crucifixion. And now, on my first morning in Jerusalem, I'm walking in the footsteps of the man himself. Talk about tingle down the spine stuff. The streets are bustling with life as we start our Via Dolorosa walk at the Lion's Gate, one of the eight gates leading into the old city. The route, and the Via Dolorosa is a route rather than a specific street. It starts in the Muslim quarter, up behind the Temple Mount and the Islamic shrine that is the golden-topped Dome of the Rock. From there it meanders through busy shopping streets, past markets, churches and schools, winding its way into the Christian quarter, before finishing inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself, the place, so Christians believe, that was both the crucifixion and burial site of Jesus. Like the city itself, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is a divided entity, with the Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Apostolic and Egyptian Coptic churches all shareholders in this holiest of holy sites. It's a bit chaotic and confusing, to be honest, what with all the hustle and bustle of priests and tourists all to-ing and fro-ing in various directions. Once inside the tiny chapel tomb, however, and proceeding into the inner chamber which marks the final station of the cross, all of that chaos just falls away. And as I stand there in the silence, staring at the now marble-covered ledge where the body of Jesus would have been laid, I am surprised to find myself somewhat overwhelmed. As I am again later that same day, when, in East Jerusalem, I pay a visit to what has become known as the Garden Tomb. Could this really be the place, rather than the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Jesus was laid to rest? Yes? No? Maybe? Who knows? For this is Jerusalem, after all, a city of many faces and multiple interpretations. It was General Gordon of Khartoum fame who, back in 1883, having noticed skull-like markings on a cliff face near this spot, decided that this had to be the real Golgotha, the place of the skull, where the crucifixion took place. It may or may not be the tomb in question, but here, on a sunny afternoon, amid the peace and tranquility of this beautiful place, it's where I like to think that on what we now know as Easter morning, Mary Magdalene is said to have discovered the empty tomb. From the Christian Holy Sepulchre Church, to the Muslim Dome of the Rock, to the Jewish burial ground on the Mount of Olives, Jerusalem is a multi-faith and cross-purposed city, but a beautiful one nonetheless. So many memories still linger for me. Here's one that I will never forget. It's my last night in the city. Darkness has fallen, and I'm standing at the top of the steps that lead down to the Western Wall, known throughout the world as a Jewish shrine and place of prayer. In daylight, it's a bustling place, but at night, it's different. As I stand there on this balmy night, looking down at the floodlit wall, it's silent and empty, save for a couple of armed soldiers on patrol. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I see him, an elderly man with a stick, the pain of simply walking etched across his face as he makes his way, snail-like, across the flagstones down below me. And I stand there, transfixed, as he determinedly makes his way right up to the wall, finally kneeling before it as best he can. Wow, I think, feeling tears prick my eyes. The power of prayer, the fortitude of faith, and from the Via Dolorosa to the Dome of the Rock to the Western Wall, the similarity within the diversity of that faith. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, lift up your gates and sing. So go the words of the well-known 19th century song, The Holy City. And so, on this Easter Sunday, for all of the prayerful, in that holy city of David and all across the world, may your God go with you.
Last night I lay sleeping, there came a dream so fair. I stood in old Jerusalem beside the temple there. I heard the children singing, and ever as they sang, methought
of... It's 11:30 on a Saturday morning, and I'm taking part in a working group discussion on Zoom with some colleagues. All our videos are switched on. In gallery view, we can all see each other on screen at the same time. But no one can tell that underneath my pink, chunky knit sweater, I'm still wearing my pyjamas. I've made an effort to impress on Zoom. A client, who coaches others in how to make the right impression on screen, took me to task early in the first lockdown of last year for my Zoom appearance. With the curtains drawn to keep the sunlight off my laptop screen and a desk light to one side of the screen, lighting up half of my face only, she was appalled. "You look like a shadowy criminal, Andrea. How can you expect people to trust you if you appear looking like that?" Duly admonished, I set up my Zoom throne in the sitting room downstairs. A small antique sofa, laptop mounted on top of a stool, on top of a coffee table, necessary for sufficient height to avoid that punishing below-the-chin camera angle. Yes, I'm vain. Camera facing away from the window, a brightly coloured artwork on the wall, carefully positioned to one side of my head, a single unlit candle standing serene on a shelf to the other side. The picture of tasteful, composed elegance, I like to think. And for work meetings, I wear my Zoom blouse, a freshly pressed white blouse that, if removed immediately after the call and hung carefully back on its hanger, can retain that freshly pressed look for several weeks before needing to be washed and pressed again. I rarely wore that blouse before COVID. I hate ironing, and the wear-to-crush ratio just didn't add up. During the summer of 2020, I attended an excellent law lecture given on Zoom by a young barrister. She appeared on screen, starched and professional, her serious gaze aimed straight into the camera lens. Halfway through the session, a long, bushy tail appeared perfectly perpendicular to the bottom of the screen. It sashayed its way gracefully behind the young woman and, as the tail approached the far side of the screen, the lecturer's right arm moved ever so slightly forward, pinning the cat responsible for this on-screen incursion gently to the desk for the remaining 35 minutes of her lecture, her gaze never once moving from the camera line. We're all vulnerable to Zoom gaffes. My most embarrassing one occurred during my regular Monday night online Pilates class. Responding to additional demand for content during the current lockdown, our teacher asked if anyone would object if she recorded our class for a video she wanted to put up online. No one else had any problem with the recording and, confident she would automatically mute all our microphones as she always did, neither did I. Lying on my mat towards the end of the class, having tightened and twisted my abdomen this way and that in various poses for nearly an hour, I became aware of a gaseous accumulation in my lower gut. Revelling in the freedom from normal social constraints in such situations and recalling the muted microphone, I abandoned myself to the moment. After the class, I saw our teacher's face close up, squinting into her own screen. "Oh dear," she said apologetically, "this new version of Zoom didn't mute the class after all." Suffice to say that my near-perfect shoulder bridge appeared as a still and silent image only in the ensuing video. We strive on Zoom to prepare a face to meet the faces that we meet, with apologies to T.S. Eliot. But a cat's face? Who can forget the plaintive voice of the Texas lawyer whose Zoom filter presented him to a court sitting as a cat while he desperately tried to reassure the judge, "Your Honour, I'm here, live. I'm not a cat." How many parliamentarians have had their contributions to national television interrupted by children or dogs appearing in the background while matters of national public interest were being discussed on TV? Earlier this year, the 9-month-old son of a weatherwoman on US TV charmed his way into the hearts of millions when he appeared on screen, toddling into view and under his mother's legs in the middle of her weather forecast. Online and working from home, Zoom gaffes have revealed us to each other in the frailty and essence of our shared humanity. We cover up our vulnerabilities, but time and again, Zoom exposes them, despite our best efforts. If you're old enough to remember Sam Eagle from The Muppet Show, you may recall his outraged speech on the subject of nudity. "Did you know," Sam thunders, "that underneath their clothing, the entire population of the world is walking around completely naked?" One of the gifts of this pandemic, if gift is how it can be expressed, has been that it has reminded us of the inherent interconnectedness of all of us, the commonality of our experience as human beings. Yes, indeed. Underneath my pink, chunky knit sweater, I'm wearing my pyjamas. And under that, well, ask Sam.
When there's loss, and there's lots of it right now, it can all collect and undo you through one loss. And this one might be far from the biggest. But out of nowhere it comes at you, sometimes from memory. He arrived to our house in the back of her Morris Minor Traveller one day in summer, a dapple of white and cream rather than the usual white and brown of his breed. Miss Turner, the huntsman, or huntswoman of the Tipperary foxhounds, tall and rangy in her jodhpurs, slung him out of the boot of the traveller and dropped him in our yard. She spoke with a commanding Anglo accent. Call him Tipster. So he learned to answer to it. It was the practice of the hunt to foster weanling puppies with farmer hunting types of the area. In that way they'd have the nourishing food of the land and the fields in which to roam. And so, over the course of a year, bone and muscle would strengthen. Tipster was mischievous. Constantly shouting at him, my father sought to quell his exuberance, whether it was chasing the hens or bursting bags of food. I thought Tipster smiled at me. I talked to him from the beginning. The hunt seemed to be all about large posses of horse riders tally-hoeing across fields, following strung-out packs of dogs who gave tongue, noses to the ground. Men wore black or green riding jackets. Women tied hair nets beneath hunting caps. Large-boned horses, sometimes half-breds, carried the heavier riders. But there were those who didn't so much hunt for pleasure as for work. These ones sat astride flighty thoroughbreds. Riders whose plan was to school horses over the double banks and stone walls of the countryside, then sell them as point-to-pointers who would go on to run under national hunt rules that might take them all the way to Aintree or Cheltenham. The hunt, you might say, was the senior infants class of Ireland's bloodstock industry, sustaining owners, jockeys, trainers, bookmakers. And then there were the huntsmen who brought colour to the stage, who wore pinks. Captain Evan Williams, master of the Tipperary foxhounds, was one of these. A bluff Welshman who rode a Grand National winner named Royal Mail. Captain Williams was himself no royalty, but a working man who earned a living from his kennels of well-bred hunting hounds. Back to my Tipster, and the eggs he broke and polished off in the hay barn while I hid the shells. The wide fields where we were Lone Ranger and Tonto, raising bandit, snipe, hare, rabbit, pheasant. The games I played with him on the hay, his belly rolling over my face, wide tongue slobbering on my hands and ears. And sometimes I told him my worries and he paused and looked at me, forehead creased. Then one day, Miss Turner returned. While she appraised his development, my brothers stole her dog biscuits. Then she took him back to the kennels and left us the Champion Puppy Perpetual Cup to put on our sideboard for a season. A year later, we went to watch the meeting of the hounds at Lismaline. Would I recognise him? There was a floppy, wide-chested, cream-coloured foxhound, a curious wanderer at the edge of the pack awaiting the blast of hunting horn. I thought it might be him. So I took a chance, though I didn't want to be seen, for it would look stupid to be calling one of these yappy, sniffing dogs. Here, Tipster! My yearning whisper was probably still filled with the old love. Here, Tipster! He slowed in his tracks, like hearing something in the wind. He looked in my direction. Was it a look of recognition? Could dogs remember? Could the sound of me, his pal, reverberate down his waxy eardrums? Could he come say hello to me once more? Then the shadow came from behind. The clatter of a horse's hooves. Captain Williams. He cracked the whip at his straying foxhound. Tipster, the deep voice growled. To heel, tipster. My body stiffened. It was him. And tipster sauntered back to the pack. And I felt my heart sort of splinter. And then a second time, Captain Williams cracked the whip. This time, the pack had wheeled around and was about to face in the direction of the first covert. The cream-coloured dog at its head. Tipster, he called this time. Lead on, tipster, good fellow. And I splintered again, first with a sense of awe, and then with loneliness and fatherliness for the dog taking up his role in the world of work and industry that brought livelihoods to racing and tax returns to the Irish Exchequer. Tipster would become a foot soldier of that industry, would become one of those purposeful pathfinders you always see burrowing alone through briar thickets that always lead the pack. And don't say goodbye.
A supper. We'd all ordered the lamb on special offer for the week, according to the website. The Deliveroo guy couldn't find my flat, and by the time I joined the call, they were sozzled, shouting at each other that this whole thing was a conspiracy, how instead we should tell truth to power and fight them on the streets. Hang on, he said, of something that I need to say. He was host, as usual. I didn't envy him trying to bring the 12 of us to order. So still. I thought he'd frozen, murmuring over the wine and matzo bread. I think we've just lost Judas, someone sighed. It's saying unstable connection. And then the screen went dead.
Here in Rosnaula in Donegal, at Easter, crowds usually flock to the traditional Holy Week services in the Franciscan Friary. This year, in their absence, I instead go on one of my favourite walks, the mini pilgrimage of the Way of the Cross in the Friary grounds. Created in the 1950s, 14 stations of the cross wind their way up the side of a steep slope, ending in a magnificent viewpoint high above the beach, looking across Donegal Bay to Slieve League. Several years ago, having reached the end of their natural lives, the dense pine trees surrounding the path were felled, leaving a desolate and barren wasteland, as nothing had been able to grow in their shade. The raw, painful-looking stumps surrounded by tree debris seem to hold none of the hope that Easter represents. But nature abhors a vacuum, and that barren wasteland came back to life with hazel, birch and willow trees rising now out of a great tangle of fresh undergrowth, pulsing with insect and bird life. Climbing the path now, there is a real sense of nature being in harmony with the God who became the very real, suffering human being depicted in the stations. The hazel's tiny white buds, topped with red tassels, mirror the crown of thorns placed on the head of Christ. Birch, while revered by our Celtic ancestors as having sacred powers of renewal and purification, also gave rise to birching as a form of punishment, based on the belief that it could expel evil spirits. Everywhere whips of bramble clutch at my feet as they try to colonise the grassy area around the stations where wild flowers flourish. Most common is the humble daisy, Chaucer's favourite flower, as the mere sight of one would serve, he said, to soften all sorrow. It is fitting that so many wildflowers here were used for healing. At this time of year, the shy, soft yellow primroses, nestling in their wrinkled toothed leaves, the hoof-shaped leaves of the sulphur yellow coltsfoot, the delicate nodding wood anemones, and the sprawling herb robert. Here also is lesser celandine carpeting the grass with a broad splash of gold. Its heart-shaped leaves were used to treat bleeding wounds, an especially good choice for this solemn place, as in dull weather it closes its golden petals as if in sorrow. Other plants which have chosen to grow here include the creeping blue of Veronica Speedwell, in honour of the kind Veronica, who at the sixth station wipes the suffering face of Christ, and the blue bright-eyed forget-me-nots, remembering the epiphany of the first Easter. Soon there will be the first tentative glimpses of bluebells, and later the hillside will glow with dense clumps of the rosy pink of rosebay willow herb. The greatest triumph of nature here, though, has been how she has transformed dead tree trunks into brilliant living yellow and green tapestries, with variety after variety of mosses thriving on and around them. Some mosses look like tiny fir trees, others are feathery and delicate. The tussocky cushions of the sphagnum moss are scattered everywhere. Its antiseptic and absorbent properties made it highly valued during two world wars when the Red Cross used it to staunch bleeding wounds. One section of the Way of the Cross consists of a tunnel cut through a dense clump of rhododendrons. You come through this chilly, tomb-like tunnel with its greenish semi-darkness just after the station depicting the crucified Christ being taken down from the cross. Nowhere do I feel the symbolism of Easter more than when I emerge out of that dark tunnel into the light and arrive at the stunning viewpoint at the summit of the hill. There is only the vault of the heavens above and the infinite horizon of the Atlantic Ocean in front. Below, The rewilded way of the cross confirms Elizabeth Barrett Browning's belief that earth's crammed with heaven and every common bush afire with God.
This morning we heard Easter Eggs Found, Easter Eggs Lost by Hester Scott. Jerusalem by Rosalind D. Underneath My Pink Chunky Knit Sweater by Andrea Martin. Captain Williams Cracked the Whip at Tipster was by Leo Cullen. A Supper was John O'Donnell's poem, and Rewilding the Way of the Cross was by Olive Travers. The music was Kleine Studie, Opus 68, number 14 by Schumann, played by Andreas Steyer. Jerusalem, sung by Joseph Locke. The Muppet Show theme tune, Epitaphius IV by Mikis Theodorakis. You Have Set My Star, played by Milos Karadaglic. And The Fox Hunters, Dusty Miller, by Kieran Turish and Kevin Doherty. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can find out more information on Sunday Miscellany and other RTE arts and culture programmes on our website. Take a look at rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.